Well, for me, going to Standing Rock kind of converged two aspects of my life. I'm a member here at Reeb, and I'm a board member of 350 Madison. So I should go, but frankly, I was afraid. There were two reasons that for that. First of all, I'm not in the best of shape, but mainly I'm a bit of a coward. Others of 350 had gone, so that was, you know, a prod. But when Reverend Karen's call came, I steeled myself and got off my rear end and emailed that I was willing to go. So traveling up, Reverend Karen, Tim Corden, Gene Skinner, and myself kind of became a moving covenant group. We also met support on the way. There was a woman at a rest stop that we had a long conversation with that was really in support. We met a Ho-Chunk tribe member at a gas station and at the Bismarck U congregation and at our hotel, including someone who traveled from Brazil. So on the way to the camp, we traveled through this beautiful but kind of stark and snow-covered landscape. And the sky was mainly blue, but a few clouds. And as we were traveling along, the sun came up from the east, and through a small band of clouds, it kind of radiated outwards. And I think Gene first spotted there was a deer on a hill, and we all looked at that, and so it kind of hit me that God was smiling on our day of prayer ahead. So the Osseti Saquin camp appeared just as we topped a hill. We got closer, and the size struck me, then the teepees, but mainly the flags. I think you've all heard about the flags. There was support from all over the country and the world. I saw a Palestinian flag, amongst other things. And then it was, you know, felt a true rainbow coalition. Come on, James. So we took them all in as we joined this rather patient line of cars waiting to enter. No one was honking the horns, you know. They were patient. So as we got into the camp, there was a large sign that said, "We are unarmed." So I felt, you know, the spirit of Gandhi, MLK, and James Reeb were there with us. So the crowd gathered near the sacred fire, a bit bigger than ours, and a tribal elder appeared. Nothing happens unless a tribal elder appears, apparently. That's the rule. And started praying in an indigenous language, followed by an English translation. Then others spoke, starting with the minister from the Bismarck UU, who, you know, we don't usually go first. I don't quite know why we did, but there we go. And she got us singing a song. And then the list included Cornel West, who proclaimed that slavery was the second sin of the United States. And then indigenous people alternated with clergy, Muslim, Jewish. You kind of get the idea. What I was thinking was essentially awe at the indigenous speakers. The others, yeah, okay, you know, I've heard Jewish and Muslim people before. Not really putting into words, but what I was concentrating on was the reality of the oppression of the indigenous people being revealed as they talked about their issues. So after that, I mostly stayed near the sacred fire because I'm not very good walking around, and warming myself by it and other fires kind of nearby. And there were a lot of other indigenous prayer ceremonies after the main gathering, and I saw those. And one example is that they take ashes from the sacred fire, put them in a can, and go around and you smell the fumes from the fire. And sometimes they have an eagle feather and they waft it at you. And the some indigenous people kind of sort of gathered it around themselves. So that's sort of like, I think it's like baptism or something like that. So there was a lot of indigenous singing and a drum, and they explained that the drum is meant to be a heartbeat. So you're boom, 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 boom as they're playing. And then I was a part of this conversation between two indigenous people, and they opened up a packet of cigarettes and they smoked, and they offered me one, but I didn't take it. But tobacco is kind of a sacred thing between them. And I was wondering, as a decline, was that an insult? I wasn't really sure. I hope not, but there we go. And then, you know, I'm standing there, and they came the announcement that the permit had been denied. And that was all, you know, pandemonium broke loose, and there was this victory singing and pounding of the drum, and loads of people were singing, and people were, you know, yelling out and so forth. It was wonderful, actually. It was intense, and it seemed to go on forever, basically. And then the elders spoke, and they invoked Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and Little Bighorn, which was their last victory. And for me, it was, well, I'd written here, a trinity of emotions, the joy of victory, the joy of witnessing the tribe's victory, and as a white man, frankly, fear. You know, they're talking about Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and the Battle of the Bighorn. Frankly, as a white man, I was a little afraid. And I, you know, frankly, I admit that. So what did I get out of this? And the answer is, that's really not important what I got out of it. What's important is that the tribe has got our support for their struggle. And it's going to continue through the North Dakota winter, which is a little worse than ours. And as they maintain their dignity, which the whites like us have failed to take away from them, despite 400 years of trying. That's it.
Thank you, James. The hearts of all people's faith must now unite in believing we can change the path we are now on. The picture in the front of your order of service is a picture that that quite frankly the folks at Standing Rock were using for publicity. It's up on top of this banner that they have is up on top of this hill where people range up as they're exploring the camp. And there's a person there who lives at camp who will take your picture with your phone of you. And then you have this picture. And so there are all these thousands of people who have been to this camp that have a picture of themselves next to a sign that says, Standing Rock Awakens the World. I just find that so beautiful. So, this trip did a lot of things for me, and one of them was that it gave me the nerve to step outside of the pulpit and preach with a little bit of paper in my hand instead of a manuscript. So I'm letting you know right off the top of my head I'm doing that. That call that we answered, I really had thought, well, you know, this would be a really good thing for me to do. There was a clergy call, a call for clergy to come back in early November or late October, and I couldn't make that. There were too many commitments. And so we hosted these folks traveling to Standing Rock from North Carolina overnight here because we're a midway point and they needed a place to stop, and it just so happened to be Sustainable Saturday night. And so they got to talk a little bit about their trip and tell us about it. And I was sitting with Chris Glad, and I kind of leaned over to her, and I was like, you know, I really feel like I should go. And she said, you know, me too. And we went, oh, all right, let's do it. Let's do it. And Chris ended up having to not go for her own reasons. But that was the impetus. It didn't come only from me. It came from hearing this call and sharing this understanding that this is something that's important. And along the way, there were so many things to find and so many things to see. The woman that James mentioned at the rest area, she worked there. She was somebody, you know, at the information booth. And she asked where we were going, and we told her. And she drew us into this 10-minute conversation. Well, she didn't draw us into it. We had this 10, 15-minute conversation with this woman about the issues, about this water is life issue. And then running into the Ho-Chunk traveler was amazing. And so I found myself starting to look for other people, you know, other people to tell about this, other people who might be going, other people that we might share this experience with. And then we got to this camp. And there's no words. There's just no words. It's like trying to describe Mount Everest. And I know Martin did a really good job with that a couple of months ago. But it's so big, and it's so... it just hits you. It just hits you. And so we drove up with this long, long line of cars, all these people just waiting to get in and waiting to get in and waiting patiently to get in. And when we got to the gate, everybody had to be cleared by a security person who worked at the camp. And when we got to the gate, they said, good luck finding a parking spot. Here you go. This is the camp. And that really set the tone for being there. You know, I mean, we had to think. We had to stop and think what we wanted to do, where we wanted to be, what our intentions were. We only had a day, right? So everything had to be very, very mindful and very present. The camp itself was so, I have never been in a more peaceful, open, welcoming place. Y'all are welcoming. You really are. There was no guarantee that there was any... that everybody was of like mind in this place. There was no guarantee that people were going to come to work. It was known that there were people who were agitators that were in the camp, people who were, you know, agitating the police during the demonstration parts. This is well known. It's well known that there's people there trying to sabotage the process. And the camp was still open and welcoming and peaceful. Everybody I saw took me at face value. And there was this matter-of-fact kind of resilience just underlying everything there. Just this matter-of-fact, yep, this is what we're here for, this is what we're doing. The sense of having to slow down and pay attention was pervasive. On the way there, I was on Facebook trying to find out where UUs were meeting up, trying to find out where clergy were meeting up, with my own anxiety of, oh, I don't know where to go, I don't know what to do, right? So I was trying to manage that by getting on Facebook. And a colleague was posting that there was a clergy meeting happening at a particular place, and people were commenting in, well, what time will this meeting be? And she texted back, she commented back and said, it'll be when the elder gets there. And so I missed that meeting. Because I got there after I would have gotten there way after the elder. And of course, the information was right up there on Facebook as soon as the meeting had happened, right? So I had my information. People took the time to look each other in the eye, you know, just walking past each other. Everybody was busy, everybody was working, and yet it was still possible to make that very basic human connection. There was a point when we were standing in circle, there were... they said there would be introductions. People of 30 different faith traditions were there, and they were inviting a leader from each of those faith traditions to introduce themselves, say a few words about their tradition, offer a prayer, if they were so moved to do. 30 people. They said, you know, this might take around 2 hours. And I don't know how long it took. I have no idea how long it took. It might have taken about 2 hours. Somewhere in the midst of that, a flock of geese flew overhead. And everybody stopped. And the elder that was speaking looked up and said, welcome, brothers and sisters. Thank you for being here with us. James described the pots from the campfire. There was sage as well going around, you know, people who were carrying buckets of burning sage, fanning it out to cleanse people. There was a young man, a young Native man that I was standing next to. And the quality of his attention was completely unwavering. Completely unwavering. Responded to everything that was said. There was this, you know how, you know, in a lot of the protest movements and a lot of meetings of activists, you know, somebody will say something that you resonate with and you'll snap your fingers. People there would say, aho, aho. And at first I thought that's what it was, that they were snapping their fingers, you know, to agree with what was being said. But then I listened more closely and I realized they were also saying it at the end of prayer. And they were also saying it when the geese went by. And they were also saying it at marked points during song. We ran into people that would help with any task they saw needing help. In fact, we were told in our instructions, we had a little resource packet going in, you know, if you see something that needs to be done, just do it. Just jump in and do it. You know, don't ask. Don't do that white people thing. You know, oh, I'm not sure if I should help with this. I don't want to step on anyone's toes. Just jump in and do it. And so, you know, we had supplies, thank you, by the way. We had a car load and a cargo carrier load full of supplies, and I had a tarp in my car, and so we piled the supplies on the tarp, three of us, and started carrying them up to the supply area. And these two young men saw us walk in and just, you know, I don't think they even asked. They just kind of stepped in and grabbed the front of the tarp and helped us over with that. There were people sorting donations at those tents where we brought the supplies, and there were piles and piles of complete disarray, clothes and sleeping bags and boxes of things and food and Band-Aids and just all kinds of stuff. And these people were going, look at all this stuff, what do we do? And then they were also going, okay, well, this is going to go over here and this is going to go over there. That matter-of-factness, you know, that this is all the work that needs to be done. Ellie had donated a bunch of insulated cups with very specific instructions that the medical tents were looking for them. And the whole way there, I'm thinking, medical tents? Insulated cups? So we went there. And, you know, the medical tents were not MASH. It was this image I had built in my head, right, of these canvas tents with these big red crosses. What it was a bunch of small yurts. And each yurt had this very, Jean has pictures that eventually we'll get up into Facebook. All these yurts with these different beautifully colored doors. And they each had signs on the front saying things like emotional wellness yurt, herbal medicine yurt. I don't remember the rest, but all, you know, and of course, right? Of course it's not going to be this big MASH thing. And of course there's going to be all kinds of medicines there. But just to see it. And so I took the insulated mugs and I went into, at the advice of somebody who I met right there. I said, yeah, what should I do with these? She said, bring them over to the herbal medicine yurt. And I went over there and I opened the door and I kind of ducked in and my glasses fogged up immediately and I couldn't see a thing. And so I, you know, I cleaned them off and saw a young man sitting doing something. And he looked up and I said, I have these cups, could you? And of course, the instant I walked in, right, it's so steamy because it's warm, but there's also all these teas being brewed. Insulated cups, right? So I give the guy my cups, and he stops. Like, he's in the middle of something, and he stops, and he looks up, and he thanks me warmly and asks me where I'm from and thanks me for, you know, being there and takes the time to do that. Just amazing. We were not at the Sacred Fire during the time of the announcement like James was. He had that singular experience. Tim and Jean and I were walking around the camp. We were trying to form, we had been asked to try to form a prayer circle around the camp to encircle the whole camp because there were so many of us. And we were in the midst of trying to do that. And word came around, you know, and we're going, it's Sunday afternoon. The Army Corps of Engineers isn't working today. this can't be. And boy, what a happy coincidence, right? That the veterans are arriving, and boy, the Army Corps just all of a sudden decided to not issue the permit? That can't be, you know? And hey, wait a minute, where are all the people? You know, there aren't enough people to do this circle. And we went back down to the Sacred Fire and realized that's where they all were. They were all celebrating. It was true. It was amazing. And then on the other hand, there was a clerk at the hotel. Her name was Savannah, a young woman living in Bismarck, working at the hotel. A hotel where people, you know, when they need a break from camp, go. A hotel that's gotten really busy lately. And the stories she told were of people wrecking rooms and were of people building fires on the bridge. What are they building fires on the bridge for? Of course they're going to try to put those out with water. And of the woman whose arm was injured and had to be rushed to New York for surgery, she thought that woman had been hit with an exploding propane tank within the camp, and that they were using that opportunity to create bad publicity for the authorities. She was upset that the roads in Bismarck had been shut down by some of the water protectors trying to draw attention to their cause. And we talked with her, and she was so fearful. You know, we talked with her both before we went, and we talked with her in the evening after we went. And after, you know, when we came back, you know, when she realized we weren't going to trash her rooms and we didn't stink and and all these things, you know, we were able to have a little bit of a conversation with her. And we said, you know, you should go. You should go. You should go and see it. You know, there isn't anything to be afraid of. These people are very peaceful. And she's like, oh, I don't know. You know, they're all bad. And it's really really stark intersection. There's a lot that will stay with me. There's a lot I'm still processing. I have a short reflection to talk through just a little bit based on some of these observations. But I asked Barb to do a second reading that pulls a few things together. And so I'd like to invite her to come and do that.
This second reading is from Louise Erdrich, the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, a band of the Anishinaabe from the Painted Drum. Life will break you. Nobody can protect you from that, and living alone won't either, for solitude will also break you with its yearning. You have to love. You have to feel. It is the reason you are here on earth. You are here to risk your heart. You are here to be swallowed up. And when it happens that you are broken or betrayed or left or hurt or death brushes near, let yourself sit by an apple tree and listen to the apples falling all around you in heaps, wasting their sweetness. Tell yourself you tasted as many as you could.
Is the reason you are here on earth. There's so much to learn from this resilience, right, of these people who have been beaten down again and again and again and again and are still willing to stand up for their self-determination and their human rights. And not just their human rights, right? They are not doing this for themselves. Well, they're not doing it only for themselves. They're doing it for their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren, and they're doing it for all of humanity. The legend, the prophecy of the black snake, which they are viewing as a metaphor for this kind of work, this pipeline, other pipelines carrying oil, carrying the potential and the definite happening of toxicity and poisoning of our land. The prophecy says when the black snake goes underground, that is the beginning of the end. And so they're viewing the black snake being routed under the Mississippi River as fulfilling this prophecy. And we'll talk more about that in January, which happens to be Prophecy Month. But that's the beginning of the end. So I had all these assumptions, and therefore all these surprises. My assumptions, several of them at least, were, for one, that white people we ran into would be judgmental about this. And that came true in some ways, this woman living in Bismarck. But the traveler, the woman at the rest area, other people who met our eyes when we said, oh yeah, we're headed to Standing Rock, surprised me. I expect us to be pretty awful. My assumption of hearing the slow speech and the awkwardness of English being the second language of many of these native folks, the assumption that I made that slow speech must mean slow thinking or slow mind, was blown to shreds by the beauty and the lyrical nature of these native folks speaking in their tongues. You know, they would switch from English to their language, and they were many of their languages because there were so many tribes there, right? But every time there was a segue, you know, into like they just couldn't hold the English anymore. They had to move forward in their own tongue, and it became so clear that the awkwardness is a language issue. I assumed I would be afraid, but I was lifted up. I was carried. And there was joy in the work. There was joy in the work. There were people dancing and smiling at each other and hugging each other. There was a gentleman who took us around trying to help us figure out to which big chief we should give our monetary donation, right? Because you don't want to just hand that off. And he's talking to, his name was Biggie. Guy's about 6'2" and about this big around. His name was Biggie. Biggie knew everybody. Everybody would greet him and shake his hand and hug him and say, oh, you're back. And Jean commented to him on that and said, oh, you know a lot of people here. And he said, yeah, we're making family. Like, just like that. Yeah, we're making family. Such joy. The biggest lesson for me is a thing I talk about a lot, and I think I just need to keep learning it, this idea of learning to follow. Learning to follow, and not just following, yes, following the folks who are being impacted by particular things and following their lead because they know what they need, but also, Tim Corden was the one who took the lead on these conversations with the hotel clerk because he's curious and because he likes to draw people out, right? What I wanted to do was go, what are you talking about? So what I saw there was that Jean and James and Tim and I, we each had a different gift in that conversation. We each had a different perspective in that conversation. And between us, we had a conversation with her instead of shutting her down or her shutting us down. And hope. The rose in the wintertime, right? Hope. When I talk about hope, I think of it as this cheerful, optimistic thing, right? I hope everything will be fine. What I learned there is that hope isn't about that, or it isn't just about that, at least. It's about determination and deliberate welcoming and hard, hard work towards something we know is better. Hope is like love. It's a verb. It's a verb. And so what they're doing there at Ossetti Shakowi is about hope. And it's what we need to be doing here in Madison. It's what we need to be doing across the nation. It's what the Pantsuit Nation is about. It's what showing up for racial justice is about. It's what groundwork is about. One of the other things that Cornel West said was, he was talking about the power company folks, and he was making very sure to call them fools rather than enemies, to acknowledge the importance of seeing the humanity in all people, even those people, to talk about how they needed education. people in the Bismarck Unitarian Universalist Congregation. There are 63 of them. They've been involved with this from the very beginning, and that is why Karen was the first to speak. She is the clergy leader that has been closest to this in the local area. They hosted us. They fed us. They had people sleeping on their floor. And in the morning, they had a little service, and they sent us out in prayer and song. They grounded us in our Unitarian Universalist faith before we set foot on the journey. And you all donated $1,400. $1,400 in 3 days. You all packed up our car full of stuff that they needed. You listened to what was needed. You looked at lists. You didn't just willy-nilly go, oh, I'm cleaning out. I need to get rid of this stuff. You paid attention. All amazingly hopeful things. I'm going to close with a reading from Mary Catherine Morin, a UU leader. She writes, "Beauty awakens and admonishes us. Sometimes it is easier to close our eyes and stop our ears. We are here in religious community, though, not to hide from the anguished cries or the tender lullabies. We are here in religious community not to protect our hearts from breaking. We are here together to borrow courage for the task of coming alive. We are here so that together we might heed the admonitions of beauty, answer the call to create, protect, and preserve." I hope I was able to describe the beauty that I saw in ways that maybe give you a little bit of hope too, because that is what I took. That is what I took, a sense that there is hope, there is resistance, there is resilience, and yeah, we can. May it be so. May we be so.